Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
We've been reading from Canto 3, Chapter 18. We're going to continue, starting with text 13. The battle between Lord Boar and Hiranyaksha. So, we just heard yesterday Lord Varaha speaking, come on and kill me, kind of talk to Hiranyaksha, and speaking chivalrous words. And the narrator is Maitreya. Maitreya is explaining all of this to Vidura, connected with an earlier topic of the process of creation and sons of Diti, sons of Aditi, and so forth. So that's the context. Text 13. Sri Maitreya said, the demon, being thus challenged by the personality of God, it became angry and agitated. And it wasn't transcendental anger either. And he trembled in anger like a challenged cobra. Purport. A cobra is very fierce before ordinary persons, but before an enchanter who can play with him, he is a plaything. Similarly, a demon may be very powerful in his own domain, but before the Lord, he is insignificant. The demon, Ravana, was a fierce figure before the demigods, but when he was before Lord Ramachandra, he trembled and prayed to his deity, Lord Shiva, but to no avail. Text 14. Hissing indignantly, all his senses shaken by wrath, the demon quickly sprang upon the Lord and dealt him a blow with his powerful mace. The Lord, however, by moving slightly aside, dodged the violent mace blow aimed at his breast by the enemy, just as an accomplished yogi would elude death. Purport. The example is given herein that the perfect yogi can overcome a death blow, although it is offered by the laws of nature. It is useless for a demon to beat the transcendental body of the Lord with a powerful mace, for no one can surpass his prowess. Those who are advanced transcendentalists are freed from the laws of nature, and even a death blow cannot act on them. Superficially, it may be seen that a yogi is attacked by a death blow, but by the grace of the Lord, he can overcome many such attacks for the service of the Lord. As the Lord exists by his own independent prowess, by the grace of the Lord, the devotees also exist for his service. Text 16. The personality of God had now exhibited his anger and rushed to meet the demon, who bit his lip in rage, took up his mace again, and began repeatedly brandishing it about. Then, with his mace, the Lord struck the enemy on the right of his brow. But since the demon was expert in fighting, O gentle Vidura, he protected himself by a maneuver of his own mace. In this way, the demon, it's spelled wrong, Hiranyaksha, and the Lord, the personality of Godhead, struck each other with their huge maces, each enraged and seeking his own victory. Oh, purport. Har Yaksha is another name for Hiranyaksha. So it was spelled right. That was text 18. Here's text 19. There was a keen rivalry between the two combatants. Both had sustained injuries on their bodies from the blows of each other's pointed maces, and each grew more and more enraged at the smell of blood on his person. In their eagerness to win, they performed maneuvers of various kinds, and their contest looked like an encounter between two forceful bulls for the sake of a cow. Purport. Here, the earth planet is called Elah. This earth was formerly known as Elavrata Varsha. I always wondered where that name came from. And when Maharaj Parikshit ruled the earth, it was called Bharata Varsha. Actually, Bharata Varsha is the name of the entire planet, but gradually Bharata Varsha has come to mean India. As India has recently been divided into Pakistan and Hindustan, similarly the earth was formerly called Elavrata Varsha, but gradually as time passed, it was divided by national boundaries. Text 20. O descendant of Kuru, that's Maitreya speaking to Vidura, because he's a descendant of Kuru. Brahma, the most independent demigod of the universe, accompanied by his followers, came to see the terrible fight for the sake of the world between the demon and the personality of God, who appeared in the form of a boar. Purport. The fight between the Lord, the Supreme Personality, Godhead, and the demon is compared to a fight between bulls for the sake of a cow. That's the previous verse. The earth planet is also called Go, or cow, as bulls fight between themselves to ascertain who will have union with a cow. There is always a constant fight between the demons and the Supreme Lord, or his representative, for supremacy over the earth. Here, the Lord is significantly described as Yajna Vayava. One should not consider the Lord to have the body of an ordinary boar. He can assume any form, and he possesses all such forms eternally. It is from him that all other forms have emanated. This boar form is not to be considered the form of an ordinary hog, semicolon. His body is actually full of yajna, or worshipful offerings. Yajna, or sacrifices, are offered to Vishnu. Yajna means the body of Vishnu. His body is not material, therefore he should not be taken as an ordinary boar. Paragraph. Brahma is described in this verse as Swarat. Actually, full independence is exclusive to the Lord himself, but as part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, every living entity has a minute quantity of independence. Each and every one of the living entities within this universe has this minute independence, but Brahma, being the chief of all living entities, has a greater potential of independence than any other. He is the representative of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and has been assigned to preside over universal affairs. All other demigods work for him. Semicolon. Therefore, he is described here as Swarat. He is always accompanied by great sages and transcendentalists, all of whom came to see the bullfight between the demon and the Lord. I want to hear what Brahma has to say, so we're going to cover two more verses. After arriving at the place of combat, Brahma, the leader of thousands of sages and transcendentalists, saw the demon, who had attained such unprecedented power that no one could fight with him. Brahma then addressed Narayana, who was assuming the form of a boar, for the first time. Lord Brahma said, "My dear Lord, this demon has proved to be a constant pinprick to the demigods, the brahmanas, the cows, and innocent persons who are spotless and always dependent upon worshipping your lotus feet. He has become a source of fear by unnecessarily harassing them, since he has attained a boon from me. He has become a demon, always searching for a proper combatant, wandering all over the universe for this infamous purpose. Purport: there are two classes of living entities. One is called Sura, or the demigods, and the other is called Asura, or demons. Demons are generally fond of worshipping the demigods, and there are evidences that by such worship they get extensive power for their sense gratification. This latter proves to be a cause of trouble to the brahmanas, demigods, and other innocent living entities. Demons habitually find fault with the demigods, brahmanas, and innocent, to whom they are a constant source of fear. The way of the demon is to take power from the demigods and then tease the demigods themselves. There is an instance of a great devotee of Lord Shiva who obtained a boon from Lord Shiva that the head of whomever he touched with his hand would come off its trunk. As soon as the boon was offered to him, the demon wanted to touch the very head of Lord Shiva. That is their way. The devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead do not, however, ask any favor for sense gratification. Even if they are offered liberation, they refuse it. They are happy simply engaging in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. Tomorrow looks like we'll be able to finish the chapter. So we're hearing lots of things. Yesterday we spent some time discussing the nature of the Sura and the Asura, and this is the personality of Godhead. He's not the devotee. Brahma is the devotee, but in very simple terms, anyone that's listened to Prabhupada's lectures is accustomed to hearing this. The demarcation between Asura and Sura is very simple. Do you accept Vishnu as the personality of Godhead? No. Asura. Do you accept the personality of Godhead that as the cause of all causes, and you're his servant? Yes. You're a devotee. Or Sura. There's this little explanation in Prabhupada Lilamrita where in the very early days Prabhupada was concerned about the duration of his life and wanting to fulfill the instruction of his spiritual master of establishing Krishna consciousness in the English-speaking parts of the world. So he was doing extraordinary things. One of those extraordinary things was he was in New York. Mukunda, then Prabhu, Mukunda Goswami, was a professional musician. He had gone to San Francisco. He had connections with people that were popular in the music realm. And Prabhupada was invited to attend a rock concert. I mean, not just attend it, but, you know, be a presenter. Very famous bands and, you know, very famous event, at least famous within ISKCON, the Moby Grape and other interesting names of bands. And, you know, huge crowds, and one of the people on the stage was Srila Prabhupada. Now, what sadhu in India would say yes to that kind of an invitation? But Prabhupada accepted, and he went, and became an icon in the counterculture rock and roll world. And so there was a the devotees, Mukunda and others, had arranged a storefront on Frederick Street. That storefront, I visited it. It's a little tiny place. It's, you know, this space that we're in is probably equal square footage, kind of long and narrow, different shape, but not big at all. And they would have, same as what was done at 26 Second Avenue, little storefront, and people would come for gatherings for classes. So there's this little description that how liberal Prabhupada was when it came to accepting persons as disciples. That changed after time, but there was this fellow with long hair and his girlfriend living together, boyfriend, girlfriend. And he had become, he had been searching and became attracted to Prabhupada and asked if he could be initiated. Or somebody asked if he could be initiated, somebody that was overseeing things. And Prabhupada gave two questions. Ask him, who is Krishna? So the young man was there, and the young man said, paused and said, Krishna's God, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the next question, and who are you? Pause. A servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay, he can be initiated. And then it was, you know, it was getting time for initiation, and this young man was attached to his long hair. And Prabhupada said he has to shave his head. And then the young man came and said, I don't know if I want to get initiated because I don't want to shave my head and have sika. And he said, Prabhupada, or Swamiji, whatever was the terminology at the time, Christ had long hair, Muhammad had long hair, and somebody else had long hair, so why do I have to cut my hair? And Prabhupada said, because I want you to. He didn't give like the why, he just, like our discussion last night about duty. Because I want you to. And there's a reason why he wanted him to, but without all of that. And so what he did was, he shaved his head on the side but left the, you know, middle part. And Prabhupada, wasn't okay, wanted him to shave the front part too, or the top part. And he did. And he became a nice devotee, an important devotee in the Hare Krishna movement. So, to become a devotee requires mercy, whether it's such liberal mercy or any other kind. And just speaking now a little bit about Prabhupada's explanation of the devotee, so the divine and demoniac, as we discussed yesterday, that chapter is there in Bhagavad Gita. Here we're seeing it in motion, or in a Puranic exhibition of the demon and the devotee. So Brahma is two things. Brahma is being referred to as Swarat. And Swarat means independent. However, living entity is not independent. And often, during lectures, Prabhupada would emphasize that fact. Nityo nityanam, chaitanas chaitananam, eko bahunam, yo vidadati kaman. And again make that reference. We're not independent. We are the servant, and there's the served. where the another term that he used, predominated, and there's the predominator. We're not independent. Yet here, the exceptional use of the term swarat is applied to Brahma. And that word swarat appears right in the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. The absolute truth, the Bhagavatam is so many things. It's a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And Vedanta Sutra is searching for the source of everything. And that source of everything is swarat. And that source of everything, swarat, is a person. Bhagavat Purana is revealing the absolute truth is the supreme person, the Bhagavan feature upon which everything rests, the Paramatma feature, the Brahman feature, Prakriti, and everything else, because he's the source of everything. Everything. Say it negatively. There isn't something that exists that doesn't rest upon Bhagavan, the Svarat, the independent. And he is not resting on anything else because he's independent. And the living entities are dependent. So that's a very important philosophical concept, and it's a very important mood for the aspiring devotee to imbibe. We're dependent. We're not independent. Because the nature of material existence is we're thinking independent. It's the nature of material existence. We're independent enjoyers of Prakriti. And have all kinds of rationale for doing so. So it's a strong material binding force is the false sense of independence, specifically even independent enjoyer. Brahma is being called Swarat in Prabhupada's explanation, not just because he's a Shaktivesh avatar, but Prabhupada's expanding it even more liberally. To some degree, to a tiny degree, we all have some tiny independence. But so, not Swarat like Krishna is. And then, especially empowered. So he's especially empowered. How is he, in what way? Well, all the other administrative personalities look up to him. All of them. Because he's the original, the architect of the universe, or the chief engineer of the universe, and he is in full knowledge of the Vedas, and they're relying upon him. And whenever they have a super problem, they go to him, and they ask him for some redress. In reading this, I was unable to recall. Brahma gives this benediction to Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu undergoing austerities. The demigods help. So Brahma goes to Hiranyakashipu and makes his body whole again with his water from his kamandalu and gives some benedictions. Now Hiranyakashipu terrorizes the universe by the benediction, the invincible benediction of Lord Brahma. I can't recall where Hiranyaksha did the same. Is anybody familiar with that story, Puranic story? But it's mentioned here that, you know, I've given him this power and now he's terrorizing the demigods. and brahmanas and innocent people. And that's now what we're hearing about the nature of a demon. Specifically, it doesn't mention austerities, but austerities goes along with it. And with those austerities, then comes propitiating a particular deva. Then the deva responds and may give some benediction. So popular amongst the demons that have that wish to receive something and then use it in a bad way, that's the nature of a duskriti. They get merit and then they use it in a bad way. That's what it means, duskriti. They do some austerity, get some benediction, and use it in a bad way. There's one example given here, but there's so many examples. Without giving the examples, there's many examples. So Lord Shiva is a favorite because he's Ashutosh and he's easily pleased, and he'll give something. Whether it's beneficial for the person or not, he may give something. There's this nice verse in the Bhagavatam, and now this is the distinction of the Sura. When approaching Krishna, he doesn't so easily give material benediction. There's this interesting contemplation. Lord Vishnu or Krishna considers, I'm not such a fool. I'm not going to give my devotee something that's going to further entangle them in material existence. I'm not going to do that. But if I do give them something that's of a material asset that they're hankering for, I do it in such a way they'll not hanker for it again. And the explanation is, Hari, with so many hands he takes away, that's the meaning, Hari, but so many hands he gives. So he gives that which is auspicious while taking away that which is inauspicious in the course of even fulfilling of some sarvakama request, some material desire request. And that's also the demigods. The demigods have material desire. Anyone that goes to the heavenly planets, which to speak of the rulers of the heavenly planets, they go there because A and B, they're devotees, and B, they have material desire. Like us. We're devotees, and we have material desire. So what happens if we don't become pure devotees? It's right in Bhagavad Gita. There's some options, depending on variables. We may go to the heavenly planets and enjoy for some time and then come back and then continue. Or we may directly take birth in a devotee family or aristocratic family or brahmana family. Even better as a devotee family and resume Krishna consciousness, get proper training from childhood and don't get distracted, ideally. Bhakti is like that. It's never lost. It will continue. It may be covered for some time, but it's never lost, and it will continue. As long as at least the opportunity to continue is given by Krishna, by giving the association of devotees that inspire and cultivate themselves, cultivate bhakti. So here we are. In the association of devotees, and who knows how many lifetimes we've been at this, and it's not getting any better. There was a period of time when I was listening every day to one lecture where it's a detail. It was having lunch when distributing books at JFK. I went out to the car and had my lunch and listened to this class every day during lunch. And it got right to the point where I shut it off because it was so inspiring. And then went inside. So Prabhupada was saying this same point, bhakti is so auspicious that it's never lost. If you complete 3%, your next life it's 4%. This is where you begin. Then he said, but don't take advantage of that, because as time passes, as Kali Yuga passes, it becomes more difficult and more difficult and more difficult. Even in the course of our short lifetime, the material circumstance of life has become more difficult and more difficult. And it's not just Donald Trump, it's Kali Yuga become more difficult and more difficult. Not just terrorism and shooting and all those things. It's the whole circumstance. It moving very swiftly down, like a whirlpool. The vortex is going down, 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 and it continues and continues. So Prabhupada's encouragement was, finish your business in this life. So we need to know to finish our business in this life, not just out of fear of yet another birth, because it's going to get worse, because that's not sufficient. That can give some inspiration in bursts of time, but complacency again sets in. So what's needed is the higher purpose. The higher purpose, as discussed yesterday, wanting to please Krishna. That doesn't change with time or circumstance. So that's the nature of the devotee. So this is Brahma speaking, these last two verses. And he's come to observe the combat, and he's a cheerleader. He's in the rooting section for the personality of Godhead. And he's expressing on behalf of the sages and the transcendentalists and the the demigods, please finish him. Because he's using this word pinprick, but he's terrible. He's a source of fear for all good people. And this is his power is beyond our power to stop him. So please, you stop him. Finish him quickly. He doesn't finish him quickly, but that's the appeal. So the earlier verses describing this combat back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Now a curious point is this mention of blood. Now we know from Ishapanishad that the body, the transcendental body of the Supreme Lord, has no veins. Right? It's very specific. So if there's no veins, how is there blood? Like Bhishma Dev, for example, firing arrows at Arjuna, and Krishna moving to get the arrows in his chest, and the marks of blood on the body of Krishna, but his body has no veins. Or Lord Nityananda being hit in the head with a clay pot by Jain Vijay, and blood on his head. No veins. What's going on? And it's similar, two things. It's part of the rasa of the Supreme Lord. It's not, he can lift Govardhan Hill without even lifting Govardhan Hill. He doesn't have to lift the little finger of his left hand. He can just say, Govardhan Hill, get up. And Govardhan Hill will get up. just by his desire or the potencies of the Supreme Lord will can move things. But he does things because it's part of the relationship with his devotees and his pastimes and his loving dealings. He behaves as if he's one of us, although he's not one of us. Again, in the purport that's emphasized consistently. There's mention in this third canto, there's mention even before this whole description of creation, the transcendental nature of the form or forms of the Lord as they appear in this world, mentioned by Uddhava, it's fully transcendental. So now comes, for example, Lord Varaha. He manifests this form, but it's an eternal form. It's not a material form. It's not like the bodies of boars in this world. Some of you may be interested to read, or may recall having read this nice section from A Ray of Vishnu. It's a biography about the life of Bhaktisiddhanta. And there's this section where even during that time, you know, before there was email and stuff, Bhaktisiddhanta was very prominent in the world. There was a professor, Ohio University or something like that, Professor Suthers, who went all the way from America to Calcutta in those early days to meet Bhaktisiddhanta, because he had, like, you know, scholarly questions about the Vedas and specifically even about Vaishnavism. And so Professor Suthers asked Bhaktisiddhanta to explain the idea of, instead of the idea of mythology, how do you, as a Vaishnava scholar, how do you explain the Lord having these forms of different species? Read that section if you want your hairs to stand on end, to see the brilliance of Bhaktisiddhanta, not only how lucidly he explains, but one by one by one, explaining, for example, the different species that exist here exist because there's a transcendental form of the Lord in that species. Now, fish is one species. Of course, there's varieties of fish. And a tortoise is another species, and there's varieties of tortoises. And lions, at least half man, half. So he explains, Bhaktisiddhanta explains, these are corresponding to what worldly people call evolution, so there's higher and higher and higher stages, and he ends up with Krishna at the topmost stage. It's amazing how he spontaneously, very clinically, breaks it down to explain forms of the Lord that are fully transcendental, and they help the worldly person to understand how Krishna is the source of everything, or the Bhagavan is the source of everything, and he has these forms in the spiritual realm. Now, that's not something that we normally hear. I'm not accustomed to hearing that expressed. As Prabhupada would do something that's really important for us to hear, he would say it again and again and again and again and again. So it's not one of those, but Bhaktisiddhanta is expressing this to a scholar, a learned man, and the man is astounded, not only at the erudition, but at the explanation. What we hear from Srila Prabhupada again and again has to do with having a transcendental conception of the source of everything. The transcendental conception is the source of everything is not material. Because materialistic conception is the source of everything is material. And we've bought into it. We've bought into it largely because we've heard it since you hear, at least in the formal education process. Mechanistic science says there's only one thing. There's matter, and the laws governing matter, and there isn't anything else. Everything can be explained according to matter and the laws governing matter. There isn't anything else. And that's because technology has produced stuff that we are involved with, somehow maybe they're right. Or they got to be right. Or aren't they right? Or somewhere in that territory. And Srila Prabhupada expressed that the greatest obstacle for furthering Krishna consciousness is this one thing, the blind faith that people have in science. And this is a fundamental. Science is not simply wanting to know. Science is propagating the idea that's atheism. And it's not a new thing. Kanada had the same idea. It's not a new idea. It was very popular during some period of time. And all there is matter, and the laws governing matter. I forget the sense, Anuvada or something like that. There's some other term. The smallest divisible particle of matter has a Sanskrit term. I think it's Anu. And everything is but a combination of those little smallest indivisible particles. And that doesn't allow for consciousness as something that's separate. It's just kind of a way over there in left field. But there was a period of time in European science where Descartes, who was a scientist, posited there's another thing, mind. And the scientific community didn't like it. And, it kind of, he proposed the idea that the mind is situated somewhere near the pineal gland, because the pineal gland is more or less in the center of the head. And then his student propounded it, but then, studying the pineal gland, it didn't show any evidence of mind. So it kind of like faded. But yet there's strong opposition to there's anything other than matter and the laws governing matter. There isn't another thing. Until this, quantum mechanic thing came along, and consciousness has an impact on observable events. That was like, a big problem for the mechanistic science folks. How do you explain that? How do you explain consciousness? There's another thing. There's other empiric evidence that also indicates there's another thing. It's not proof of anything. It's just the current set of matter and the laws governing matter, and there isn't another thing. There's physical events. There's empirical events that don't match that model. You have to look at another model, unless you're just, stubborn. And, of course, some people are stubborn. Some people are intellectually powerful and stubborn. And that's a demon. By definition, because there's the non-acceptance, the purposeful non-acceptance. of the personality of Godhead. So back to the messages of the purport, this form of Lord Varaha is all spiritual. All of the forms of Vishnu are all spiritual. And to some people that's perplexing. How do you have so many forms? And an answer could be, why not? If there's unlimited potency, why there's not unlimited forms? Well, which one of those forms is the source of everything? And how can you have multiple sources of everything? It's not multiple sources of everything. There is one source, and these are expansions of that one source. So without reference to scripture properly understood through disciplic succession, without that descending mercy coming into one's life, it's a subject matter that can't be understood. Without some faith, just as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, without faith, moga asha moga karmano moga jnana vacheta saha rakshasim asurim chaiva. One's defeated. As far as knowledge, even of this, what to speak of knowledge of transcendence, knowledge of this is incomplete, and therefore they have to continually adjust and adjust and adjust and adjust. Forever adjusting the conceptions of what this is, what to speak of transcendence. The Bhagavatam is giving us an understanding, a principle-based understanding of especially the third canto. Everything comes from one source. And here's how it happens. It happens again later in this canto, Kapila's teachings. But earlier it's just Maitreya explaining to Vidura. It's done in a different way, but it's, you know, there's one source. And that source has its influence all the time. That's the argument of, or the slanderous speech of Hiranyaksha. You're hiding from us. You keep yourself invisible. And in that position of invisibility, you're showing favoritism to the demigods. But I'll finish you. Anyway, to be continued tomorrow. Any discussion? Well, say it negative or say it positive. When the deluding potency covers the living entity, they can't see. Or say it negatively, Prabhupada's phrase, dog obstinacy. You know, determined to be the enjoyer independently. Even the indication is otherwise. Covered by the deluding potency. Pashyati, na pashyati. And once under the influence of that deluding potency, it's hard to get out. Even one wants to get out. And the method for trying to get out is another version of the deluding potency. Because there's an aversion to the dependent position. What brings us here, keeps us here. Something else? Yes.
Maharaj, just now as you said, the aversion to being independent, the dependency. So I understand that we have to be dependent on the Supreme Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But again, some experiences in life makes it difficult to be a dependent. I'm not saying on the material things, but even to the aversion towards, the bad experiences that we have gets carried over to being a dependent on Krishna too. So I'm concerned about that. It should be a happy thing to be a dependent on Krishna, logically speaking, but the experiences that we might have that could prevent from enjoying being a dependent on Krishna.
This is like a child saying, "Mommy, Daddy, you didn't give me what I wanted." When mommy and daddy have a reason why they didn't give to the child what they wanted. And it's not, you know, mommy and daddy are cruel. They know what's in the best interest of their child. No, they may make concessions anyways. But some things they just... So, well, wait a minute. The desire that didn't get fulfilled, my expectation that didn't get fulfilled, is that a bad one? So why wasn't fulfilled? The personality of Godhead as the loving Father and His potencies which are acting under His direction are helping us to learn a lesson that we'll never have to learn again. Or say it a different way. When you return to the spiritual world, you've learned your lesson. There's no living entities in the spiritual realm that have one foot in two different boats, the material and the spiritual. They have only one interest. So our tendency is both. And so we're expecting both. But it's not, it's one of the things that we need to learn is it's not both. And even so, if something is being, an expectation isn't being met, or a bad experience in the past, why did I have this bad experience? Well, it has something to do with misuse of free will, and there's responsibility for that misuse of free will, and it needs to be addressed, and there's consequences. So that's not a an act of cruelty or neglect or not kindness. You know, the spiritual life is supposed to be happy and fun. So we're taking responsibility for our misuse of free will for who knows how many lifetimes. We should accept it. Whatever the past and the present. So it's then, in other words, it's restoring our relationship with Krishna that we violated, he didn't. And there's consequences for our misdeeds, misuse of free will, independent desire that led to independent action that led to, you know, foolishness that caused us and others difficulty. So there's accountability for that. And we're enduring it. So where to turn your attention in circumstance like that is not just, you know, grit your teeth or bear with it because it's going to get happiness only going forward in time. I just have to, like, endure the reactions of my past misdeeds. Going forward in time in the spiritual realm, there can be some difficulty that looks the apparent difficulty, like the great devotees in worldly experience and even in Goloka. Separation from Krishna looks very painful. Watch out. You become attached to Krishna, you'll have to experience the pain of separation. Wait a minute. I don't know if I want to go there. Because I want it to be happy, not painful or, you know, stressful. But that's ecstasy. Don't place what it's, end it this way. One of the things that I've learned and try to encourage others, when you come to the position of surrendering to Krishna, please know that you're surrendering under his terms, not yours. Otherwise, you're not surrendering to Krishna. It's a business deal. Now, I got your message. However, there's some past expectations that weren't met or some bad experiences, and that carries with me when I'm trying to go to the place of taking shelter of Krishna, depending upon him. That was... So it's going forward in time. He knows what's best. If I don't have that confidence, or if it becomes something else, he's the order supplier, then that's not... It's not the position of I am the servant, he's the master. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives this example. Two examples. One example is, it's in Chapter 3 of Madhurya Kandamani. If a child becomes ill, they have fever, the parents may, or the doctor may, prescribe some bitter medicine, but it's not punishment, it's to help cure the disease. And the bitter medicine, after some time, then the fever subsides and the bitter medicine isn't needed anymore, but it's because there's a disease has been contracted, and it's not punishment. Or another example he gives is, if there's a servant and the master, and the servant is grossly negligent in the service to the master, the master may say, you can go wherever you like, I'm not going to be your master anymore. But if the faithful servant stays without the expectation of some pat on the head or some reward, and just continues in the mood of being the dutiful servant of the master, then after some time, however long, the master, it's all forgotten, and the relationship of servant to master is restored. So that's similar to what I've been saying. We made some not just a mistake, a big mistake. We did some things harmful, like Brahma stealing the calves and the cowherd boys. That's like very intimate. Or Indra sending torrents of rain. And to us, even demigods, what to speak of us. And our whole life has turned away from Krishna. And so, you know, I had some bad experiences when I turned away from Krishna. Because I turned away from Krishna. And that those bad experiences was to teach us it's not a good choice you made. Turn again to Krishna. But if we're self-centered, it's all about me rather than all about the relationship with Krishna. And cultivation of bhakti is it's all about our relationship with Krishna from the position of servitor to the served. I understand, getting stuck in some bad experience kind of paradigm. We're responsible for that. Not lack of Krishna's kindness. Yes. The importance of regret in the progress of Krishna consciousness. Well, looking at the clock, and I'll keep it short. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, two things. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, for a Vaishnava, regret is a form of tapa. And tapa in the sense of my past involvement with matter, I regret that I misused this valuable human form of life, and instead of using it properly, I misused it, and then whatever the details may be, and I feel some regret. And that's the regret. The second part is the regret is meant to be impetus to go in the correct direction. When regret creates a situation of getting stuck in lamentation, that's tamagun. So the proper application of regret is to move to sattvagun and transcendence. So regret is a good thing, provided it leads to the impetus for the purification of regret to going in the right direction. I learned a lesson, let me not repeat it. That's the benefit. Tapa. A Vaishnava form of tapa. It's not that tapa means physical austerity that hurts. That's a common conception. It's accepting some inconvenience currently. Acknowledging there's a higher purpose besides that inconvenience. So I've acted in a wrong way, and so I have regret. Now let me move to the right way. And I need proper guidance, and I need strength beyond my own strength, because there's the consequence of my wrongdoing that I have regret for that's upon me. So regret is part of that is purification from the reactants coming to me for that bad thing or the wrong thing. But it doesn't stop there. It's go the rest of the way. Okay, I'm going to end. Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.